This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Welcome to the Hunt of Ore podcast, powered by Sportsman's Empire, where we celebrate the hunting and fishing lifestyle through the utilization and consumption of our wild game. No egos.
Fork in hand, beer in the other.
No status.
A piece of red meat on a hot grill and turn it into a burnt offering.
Just catch it, cut it, cook it.
This is episode 151, Dish Mastery with Adam Berkelmans. On this episode of Huntivore, Nick is joined by recipe guru Adam Berkelmans. Adam is an author of hundreds of recipes and dishes. However, our focus isn't on the recipe itself, but a mastered dish. The guys talk about a couple of their favorites where they have made changes and different variations to make the dish their very own. Mastery is more about more than following the list, but tweaking the list, going with your gut, and taking things to another level. Get ready to add a little bit of this and a pinch of that on this episode of Huntivore. Well, hey, folks.
Cool.
Beautiful afternoon here in Michigan. Yeah, we're getting some mild temps. We're in the 70s, no 80s yet. I think there's a warm-up coming to us very soon. But at the same time, warm days, cool nights. This is perfect weather for campfires. I know my wife and I and the kids have been next to our patio fireplace. We've been out there a bunch, roasting marshmallows, just living the summer life. Not a lot of wild forage picked up other than I had some ramps earlier. It was a small patch, so I chose not to do a whole lot with that. We'll see what happens next year. We'll see if we can expand that little honey hole. Mushrooms, yeah, no go for me, basically on time. But yeah, now we're getting into the summer. We just finished up with Total Archery Challenge. Shoot, that would be an episode all in itself. I both felt successful and unsuccessful. Successful in the fact that I hit the moose at 130 yards, hit it just outside the eight ring, felt very, very proud of that. But then I seemed to dodge the 10 ring every other shot. I think I got beat by two of my buddies, just because I could not find the scoring rings, couldn't make that happen. But you know what? That's a detail that, you know, once we get into the hunting mode, it's more or less, we're going for the kill shot. We're not going for the, point rings. So my kill shot is a little bit lower than what, all the 3D companies have decided the kill ring is. Mine's a little bit lower. So anyway, I was hitting that spot. Felt pretty good there. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Today, we are getting switching over to a little bit of recipe talk. And not specifics, but at the same point, we get to a point where we like a recipe, but we want it to be a little different. And we make some changes. And we make a few adjustments here. And pretty soon, after we make that dish three or four times, it begins to take on a new identity. And it becomes something that's living, and it becomes something that we can take some ownership of us, or of that recipe. So talking this afternoon with Adam Berkelmans of the Harvesting Nature Crew, host of the Antler and Fin podcast. He's also a regular on their Fish and Wild Game podcast, their managing editor, and I would say a whiz in the kitchen. We got Adam this afternoon. Adam, how are things in your neck of the woods? Has summer kicked off just the right way for you?
Yeah, I would say so. First of all, thanks for having me on again. Always a big fan of yours and happy to be on. Yeah, summer has been great here. We had a really good spell of warm weather. I'm up in Ontario, Canada. So we had a bit of unseasonably warm weather, which was a nice start, and it's cooled down recently. But yeah, I've been getting out. We're just getting into doing a lot of like pike fishing and foraging. Kind of the spring foraging is ending and the summer foraging is kind of starting. We've been out just spending as much time outside as we can. So yeah, it's been a lovely beginning to the summer.
Excellent. Excellent. You mentioned just your summer foraging. When you're getting into the heat of summer, long days, you know, sometimes it might be a lot of rain, sometimes it might be a real dry spell. What are some things in season right now that you're going to be, or the things that you are going to start looking for? What are some of those things that you're looking for as far as summer forage goes?
Well, right now, big one that's popping up around here is milkweed flowers. So milkweed's an interesting wild edible in that it doesn't agree with everyone, but most people can ingest it. And you can pick the shoots, which are, we're past that stage now. And then the flower buds kind of start opening. This is common milkweed I'm talking about. Not all milkweed is edible. Mm-hmm. Common milkweed is. And the flowers start popping up almost like broccoli florets. And then they can be cooked a lot like broccoli, and they're really tasty. And then the flowers open up, and you can still continue cooking them like that. I'm also cooking up like burdock stems. Usually in the spring, I'll dig up roots. And then as the plants start to develop a stem that will eventually turn into those sticky Velcro burrs, that stem is actually edible too. So I use that in a lot of stir fries and stuff like that. And then I'm getting to the point here, the season seems to have arrived earlier than normal. So everything is popping up earlier than I used to, but I think the chanterelles will be popping up soon. So I'll be on the lookout for those guys for sure. I'll be out looking for mushrooms basically from now until the frost kind of hit in October, November. So yeah, that's what I've been kind of on the lookout right now.
Nice. Yeah. Golden oysters is big in our area.
They seem to pop up here as things get warm. I have yet to come across a chanterelle. I don't know. Maybe those spores haven't quite gotten across Huron yet. They didn't get all the way into Michigan. But yeah, they are very elusive. I haven't found my little patch of those yet. But
funny, yeah, the golden oysters, along, I don't think have ended up here yet.
Oh yeah.
That's right. The golden oysters, because they're an invasive mushroom, they're making their way up through southwestern Ontario. I'm in eastern Ontario, so they'll probably be here in a couple years, but those spores haven't arrived for me yet either.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it was, oh shoot, I forget. Somebody put out a little booklet, and it basically was saying, like, we're going to eat our way through invasives. They were talking about the carp in the Mississippi, picture of the wild boar that's on there. And, you know, I really enjoyed that. I don't think there was necessarily a page for golden oysters on there, but it's like one of those things like, hey, if we're going to maybe solve some issues here, it's going to first start with getting those on the plate. And so, yeah, maybe eating more of the fruiting buds. I'm not sure how to stop fungus other than a fungicide, and you know, we're only seeing the fruiting body at that, we're not seeing the mycelium. But yeah, at the same time, I feel like I'm doing good by eating as much of those as I can. Definitely. But now we're getting into the meat of our topic here, Adam, and I got a lot of questions while I was up at TAC, and people were talking about recipes, so they were talking about, you know, which authors they've been looking at, or who wrote the newest cookbook, you name it. Those names got thrown out. You know, there's the Ranellas, there was the Hank Shaws, and it's going through all of those. And as much as these gentlemen have put so much effort into their books, they have given everybody a great start. A recipe or a dish doesn't have to end there. And in fact, like, the written recipe of a dish takes its own life as you make little changes, as you make little additions, and pretty soon it moves off of the page and it becomes its own unique dish. And what I'm coining that is mastering the dish, not just following a recipe line for line, not just memorizing the ingredients that go into it, but the mastery and control that you've been able to make something that was something different earlier. I know we've got several examples, and I do want to talk about the one that I've really grabbed onto, and that was Hank Shaw's, because I do want to give him credit for that. The barbacoa, the venison barbacoa recipe that Hank put out is automatically a great starting point. You can find it in the Buck Moose book. I believe he still has it online at his Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook website. But it's a launching point that you can then be able to take that and go to several different directions. Having made it a number of times, each batch, I've tweaked one thing. I know my boys for a while didn't like anything spicy, or they would just drop the S. You know, when they were young, Pisces. Yeah, they didn't like anything like that. So I had to cut the chipotles out of that completely. And I ended up with then a shredded venison that could go into stroganoff, that could go into noodles, that could go into several different directions that wasn't necessarily had to go into a taco. Now that we've come along a little bit further with the boys, they do enjoy a little bit of spice. Chipotle has made its way in, but then I wanted to start experimenting with cocoa, kind of trying to get more into the moles in Mexican cuisine. They use a lot of that cocoa powder. And so incorporating that into the recipe, it's not written anywhere in there, but now I'm keeping notes about, like, ooh, you added too much. You could taste the bitterness of that chocolate. Or the next time it was like, it wasn't apparent. But I've now fine-tuned it to where I've got my cocoa in there. As we were getting started with this episode, you were alluding to a dish that you've brought from its infancy and brought it to something that you've mastered. It's now a favorite. It's now a go-to. And I can't even remember what you're telling me. I've never heard of this dish before. Talk to me about your journey with this dish.
Yeah, so the dish I was talking about is called biryani, which is an Indian or South Asian, and there's iterations in Southeast Asian and Middle East as well. And it's like a mixed rice dish, so usually meat or fish or vegetables or a combination thereof, cooked together with basmati rice with some sort of gravy and lots of spices, as you often see in Indian food. And it creates this like beautiful, fluffy, incredibly flavored, tasty dish that's really hearty and stands in as like kind of a main dish in a meal. And I always loved it. And I've been, you know, if I order Indian food, there's always going to be a biryani accompanying like my meal. Like I wouldn't ever bypass that part of a meal. I just love it so much. And it's a really beautiful dish too. There's often saffron in it, different colors, turmeric and stuff that make this like kind of golden, beautiful color that just, I don't know, whenever I make it at home now and I take a picture, it just always turns out so lovely. So yeah, I chose that because it was being one of my favorite dishes. I wanted to make it at home, obviously. And I had quite an arc kind of from the beginning to the end of you know, the first iterations generally ending up not so great. And having to kind of start from square one again to do it right, which is really interesting because, you know, generally when I try cooking new foods, things generally work out for me. Like I'm pretty good in the kitchen enough so where that if I've, you know, I generally don't follow recipes too much. If I try to make something, it usually works out to some extent, but biryani really kicked my butt. Like, it took me a lot of times to get it right. And I felt like this, it would be a great dish to talk about today because it's kind of complex. You know, when you're trying to master, you know, like a vinaigrette or mashed potatoes or maybe even a seared steak or something, it probably doesn't take too many tries to eventually get to where you like it. But a very complex dish like this, you know, some other examples could be like baking a really good loaf of bread, making something like French cassoulet, like these more complex dishes with a lot of different things and a lot of variables can often take a lot longer to master than something simple. So
absolutely. So
biryani was definitely mine.
So your starting point with the biryani, did you happen to do like a quick Google search like and just find a base recipe, or you were going merely on the last time I had it at this Indian restaurant, it had this and this, and I'm just gonna try that. I'm gonna mix those number of items together and see what I get. So you started from a blank line sheet of paper. You didn't even have a base when you first started making this.
Yeah, I think the first time I tried, I just tried off of my, you know, having tried the dish and thinking that I knew kind of what went into it. And that was a pretty abject failure. So I'm like, okay, that was a bad move. Maybe I'll do some research. So I looked up about, you know, and this is often something I'll do if I'm cooking from food from other cultures. I'll look up 20 different recipes, scan them through, see what people said about them, shut it all down, and then make it myself, not following these recipes, just kind of getting a feel for what's supposed to go into it, the techniques involved, those kind of things, and then kind of making it with my own spin. And that usually works very well for me, but for biryani, it did not work. I ended up with something that tasted okay, but, you know, the texture was off, the rice wasn't fluffy, the consistency wasn't right, there was like something really missing. And after a couple of batches of that, I'm like, okay, I'm doing everything wrong here. This isn't working out like it normally does for me. So I have to, you know, actually really start from scratch.
Eat your bad mistakes. Can I put that in the notes here for people that do get frustrated? Hey, if you make a bad batch, nobody died. You know, you make a bad batch of it. You started out fresh. You just eat it and make it again. Or, you know, the dog will enjoy whatever you give it. But I love how you said there, like, version one, you know what? It wasn't the greatest, but at the same time, you didn't give up in this point. Like, there wasn't a, oh, I'm not made out for this. And I feel like there's a hard transition from the woods and people learning lessons. They're like, well, I'll just wait for the next deer. Like, I'll try again later. But when they bring it to the kitchen, oh, I don't know what to do. I quit. Like, we quit right away. Where's that drive? Where's that, you know, keep hammering in the kitchen? Keep mixing? Keep frying? I don't know what we want to keep calling it. But anyway, I do want to say that, you know what? Adam does not give up. And I don't think you should either. Sorry, that was just a quick, like, hey, I need to make sure that we point that out as a hot topic right there.
Yeah, you got to stay tenacious on it, just like a bulldog that's not going to release a script. And you're like, no, I'm going to get this. I'm going to do it right. I'm going to make it really good. And I know I can, because everyone's capable of this, whether you're doing it, you know, following a recipe or going a little wild. You can, like, everyone's capable of it. So just, yeah, keep trying, because you will get it right. If you're searing steak and you mess it up 5 times, you'll probably get it right on the 10th time. So just keep doing it. And then once you have it right, then you can move on. You know, once you have it right, you'll do it right every time. So it's worth getting to that point, for sure. And not giving up. You put so much effort into, you know, like scouting and gear and the research and the hunting and all the stuff goes into it, the driving and the early mornings and the waiting in the woods and the bug bites and all this stuff. And then to just, like, get it home and be like, I don't know what I'm doing in the kitchen. Like, like, just continue that work a little longer and you'll get something where you'll be very happy.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. So I didn't mean to interrupt. So now we've went from version one, no good. Got to go back version two. Now we're looking at some of the changes we made. What were some of those changes that you made for version two?
So trying out version two, I like I said, I looked up a bunch of different recipes and try to stick to less of the kind of like American trendy recipe developers and more like the established Indian recipe developers who, you know, this is what they grew up with. This is what they're part of their culture, you know, and they know what they're doing better than I do. But still, I have an ego and I have instincts. And I thought to myself that, well, I'll take a little bit from everything and then do it the way I want to do it. So I followed half of their advice and discarded the other half and kind of did my own thing. The techniques that I think should work in the kitchen, the techniques I usually use, and I came out with another subpar product. It still didn't really work out. It was better than the first time, but it didn't really work out. There was still, I couldn't get that consistency that you get from the restaurant style ones. Mm-hmm. And when you're making biryani, it's a big batch. So think of like a huge Dutch oven full of chili or something. Like, I'm making that much every time. I'm like, yeah, damn, I got
like a paella. So it's an all in deal. Yeah, like, it's exactly going to feed so many people.
Yeah.
You know, it's a week's worth paella's of leftovers if you mess it up.
Definitely.
There is a little pressure.
Yeah, for sure. It's a lot of food to continue eating. And paella is actually a great example. If you've had paella before, it's quite similar in essence to a biryani. So yeah, like lots of spice, lots of interesting things going on, lots of rice. Like it's pretty similar. So tries number 3 and 4 or 5 or whatever, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna stop using wild game and move to domestic meats, because they're a little more reliable in terms of what you can expect from them, have a little more give in terms of fat content and whatever, and less variability in terms of like toughness and age and everything that you might encounter with a wild game. So I thought, you know, I should make this easier for myself rather than trying to challenge myself when I can't even do it to begin with. So I basically got my tee. Instead of playing hardball, I was like, I'm going to back up to tee ball here.
Yep, finally put another tee. All right, let's figure. Oh, other end of the bat. Okay,
yeah,
here we go.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. So then I'm like, there's obviously something I'm doing wrong here. So I stopped and I looked once again at these traditional kind of authentic recipes from people who grew up with this dish, paid more attention and left my ego at home. And the techniques and everything I learned, setting aside, because, you know, Indian food is cooked differently than European food or Chinese food or Mexican food. Like, they have their own techniques. And so I followed exactly what you're supposed to do. So I followed every point. You had to, you know, soak the rice. I had to marinate the meat before putting it in, which usually I don't do with stews and stuff like that. I cook the biryani in a Dutch oven, so they recommend making a simple dough and then pressing that dough around the rim of the pot, and that creates like a sealed vessel, so the steam can escape, which I had kind of ignored the last time. I overcooked the onions, because usually the onions I want like a nice golden light brown, and Indian cooks will often cook them more into the darker territory. I just followed every single step along the way like it was supposed to be done from a true like Indian. I was cooking there's tons and tons of different variations of biryani, first of all. So I was cooking a Hyderabadi, which is a Hyderabad is like a city in India, and they're kind of probably the most well known for their biryani. Like, that's kind of the main dish of the place.
Is that northern India or southern? Because so, I've also heard within Indian culture, like that north-south divide, there's a huge difference. Even fuel, I think it was the northern, doesn't have a lot of trees, and they use a lot of cow dung as their fuel for cooking when they first were settling the area. So you see a lot of long stews. You see a lot of like boiling and braising, not a lot of high heat, high intensity, because that dung would just smolder at that point. So it would be these longer cooks.
Yeah, definitely. And probably another good reason to seal your vessel, your cooking vessels, if you get them overdone.
Yes. We don't, as much as we don't want the stuff going out, the moisture going out, we don't want everything going in.
Yes. That's the smoke flavor I probably don't want associated with my food.
Right.
Have you never done it? You never know. But that's totally correct, though. Northern and Southern India have extremely different cooking styles. It's a huge place. It's got a lot of different terrain, a lot of different vegetation, a lot of different methods and peoples, cultures, all kind of happening. So Hyderabad is kind of like central south-ish. If you get further south, you kind of leave meat cooking behind. Like, they don't cook nearly as much meat in the south, unless you're looking at some places like Goa, which has a Catholic presence. So the meat is generally more pork and meat are generally eating more. And as you go further north, goat and mutton and lamb and chicken are eaten more often, and less emphasis put on like coconut and different tropical kind of flavors. So this is, I think, I'm not totally sure. I'm not like an expert by any means in any cooking.
Gotcha. But, take all this with a grain of salt, folks.
Yeah, I would say this area is kind of in the transition zone between north and south. And this dish is most often made with chopped bone-in goat, but it's also made with bone-in chicken. So if you're getting it at a restaurant, you can tell if it's a more authentic version or a better version if they're cooking it with bones in rather than just like chicken breast or something like that. I was making a chicken one. I followed everything I was supposed to do. I did it to the T, which is like very unnatural for me. I've never followed a recipe from start to finish. Even if it's like a box of mac and cheese or something like that, I always mess it up or mess around with it. So this time I stuck exactly to the recipe, and my biryani came out beautifully. And it was the texture I wanted. It was the flavors I wanted. It looked perfect. It was beautiful. I'm like, okay, now I have a starting base from which I can go. So I made that again, and it turned out good. At this point, I've made this dish so many times, and I'm not one to repeat dishes too often. So we usually eat something different pretty much every day here. Mm-hmm. So now I've made this dish like 6 or 7 times, which is very rare for me, but I was getting obsessed a little bit with the need to get this right. And then once I had that technique down, and I knew the way to make it, and it was a way that went in some ways against my instincts that I've developed cooking, because it's just such a different cooking method. Once I had that down, then I'm like, okay, now it's time for me to start experimenting again, like I was at first, but now I have the right base to carry on with that, to like my first, you know, stepping stone is there. I'm not just like leaping over the edge of a cliff anymore. So then I started playing with it. I started adding wild ingredients, moving away from domestic again. I made like a rabbit biryani, bone-in venison shank, like chopped bone-in venison shank, some lamb biryani from lambs that I butchered, goat biryani. And then I even strayed into making like a totally vegetarian biryani made from wild nettles, like stinging nettles.
Oh, yeah.
So I basically gathered a ton of nettles. I blanched them and chopped them and then kind of blended them into a gravy. And then the whole rice is tossed with that. So it's just like green flecked, really beautiful. So I was moving from like the, you know, the meat ones that I knew into different territories with like wild ingredients, you know, and trying out different spice combinations and stuff like that. So what I really learned from that is that you need to master the basic first, and then you can really move into the uncharted territory of doing yourself or removing things that you may not, like you said with the chipotles with the kids, or, you know, if there's certain flavors you don't like or certain things you do like, if you want more spice, that's the time to play around with it. If you try to play around with it right away and it's a pretty complex recipe, you might run into some roadblocks like I did.
Yeah. And even, I mean, shoot, let's bring it right back into being in the field. You're sighting in this rifle for a long distance and you take care of, or even your bow. You don't start trying to fix windage and elevation at the same time. You work on one, you get your windage right, and then you work on your elevation, or vice versa, whichever you want to do. But you isolate what you're trying to do. When you've got a recipe, when you're making something on here, yeah, you could have these grand, audacious ideas that you want to, well, I want to try this and I want to try this. But like you said, your first run at it, man, there was too much going on, and it didn't go the right direction. And you had too many variables going on. Maybe this protein didn't work with the rice for some odd reason, or the vegetables I used, you know, I didn't give enough color to them. And so they just ended up blah in the bottom of this, you know, tasteless gravy. Like where you went wrong has too many avenues. But just like you said, hey, I went through and I made it domestically. I made it dot for dot on this recipe. Now I nailed it. I know that to be the standard. And now from that, let's deviate from that standard. Mm-hmm. You were then energized to then add in the wild, to then start playing with adding the wild, you know, foraged edibles. You're looking at different proteins at that point. Shoot, to take a dish, to be able to flex from a white meat, like the rabbit, like you said, your first version you did, that translates well with chicken. But then you even went, well, now let's go back to the red and let's add a venison shank in there. You know, mm-hmm. Both the white and the red, they have different qualities, but because you had that base down, you were then able to fine tune where that direction was going to be able to go and make the venison successful. Make stinging nettles a successful dish, which those things are the bane of my existence. I don't, knock on wood, I don't get poison ivy. I'm not allergic to it. And I take that as a superpower. I take that as a blessing from the Lord. Maybe that was the gift I'm supposed to do something with, but I have been caught too many times in a nest of nettles and wanted to just die. The stinging sensation is so intense on me. Like I sit there and just spray the anti-itch, the anti-sting stuff all over me, trying to get that stuff to wind down. I tell you, I still, the hairs in the back of my neck stand up when there's stinging nettles. So anytime nettles get put into a dish, like, I'm like, yes, stick it to that plant in particular.
But how do you like that, nettles?
exactly. Yeah. So I've picked nettles before, but they were too mature. I didn't get the delicate flavors. Alan out of Minnesota. I'm blanking on his last name.
Burgo?
Yes. Alan, awesome forager. He led me to some different ideas that I can do with the nettles. But yeah, he was also like, the ones you picked, those are pretty mature. I don't think you're going to get what you're looking for out of those. But yeah, he's helping guide me to gain vengeance. I guess that's what I'm going to call it on these nettles. So to know there's another dish for nettles, I'm totally in on that. So that was a great story, great analog of, you know what? Like, I want to master this dish, and you enjoy it so much, and it's that struggle and success, the back and forth. When you see, for my wife example, when she changes something with her sourdough recipe, she got into sourdough a couple years ago and pulls that out, and when she brings it over, you know, and she's like, look at that crust. And she cuts into it, you know, and opens to see the crumb on the inside, the open pores. She sets it down, arms, and, you know, does a lap around the island. Like, you see people do that and you're like, what a bunch of weirdos getting excited about that. But it's like, you're seeing the combination of work. You're seeing an artist go for something. You're seeing the, you know, a high level risk there. We're as cooks, and especially as wild game cooks, we have an image in our mind. We have a taste profile that we want. We have a texture. And when we nail it, that's as best as bringing down the animal again. That's like the hero shot that we're going for. So thank you for laying that out, Adam, just even in that one dish, you know, from failure to success. That just lays out exactly, I think, what gets us all fired up.
Mm-hmm. And I would say for people, if you're looking to find a place to nail down some of these techniques and recipes, there's a website called Serious Eats. And they have a lot of different, you know, it's not wild based at all, but they have a lot of different kind of pages where they break down everything to just the basic techniques, which you can then grow on and develop. And, you know, Harvesting Nature, the website, also has a lot of stuff like that. Just like, get your techniques down, get a recipe and say a chili or something and just keep making it until you have it like where you want. So start with the recipe, make observations. You know, Alton Brown, he had shows on the Food Network there for quite a few shows.
Yeah, Good Eats. Oh, the, man, like, I cooking. Could stream that.
Yeah,
forever.
Good Eats. Yeah, he's great. Yeah, he's great for that kind of stuff. Breaking things down to the minutia and then growing them back into something that's just simple and tasty. He said cooking is an observation-based process that you can't do if you're completely focused on a recipe. So you got to learn that recipe, but then you got to use your observation skills. Your stove is not going to be the same as a recipe developer's stove. Your sensitivity to salt is not going to be the same as a recipe developer's. So make the recipe first. Make your observations and say, you know, if you need to take notes or if you have it all up in your head or you rely on your spouse or children or friends to give you critiques. Use your observation skills, find the pain points and the problems that you might have encountered, and then fix those. Fix those, you know, one at a time if you need to, until the end product isn't necessarily what the recipe called for, but is exactly what you want. Use that recipe as a stepping stone, not as a like written in stone, you know, it's not like a stone tablet saying you have to stick to this forever. Like, use it as a stepping stone. And I think you can fine tune these things to exactly what you want, and you'll be much happier for it.
Yes. I mean, shoot, just like you were saying there, not only is it a science, because there is science that's going on in cooking, baking, you name it. It's all science based. Things are going to happen. Reactions are going to happen. And you need to get it to certain temperatures for certain reasons. And all of this stuff has to happen. But at the same time, you're given a different tube of paint. You're given a different palette with your, just like you were saying, the oven, the stove, the charcoal, the smoker, you name it. Things are going to be a little different. And then on top of that, your taste palette is going to be all over the place as well. So, you know, basically creating art for the people that are going to be having that. It's like that fine, like you got to cross both sides of that fence. You can't just ride it. You can't ride the top of it and do neither. You need to jump off on one side, do everything to get the scientific correctness, but at the same time, jump back over and make sure that the art, the observation, the beauty of what you're trying to make come across as well. And here we thought we were just going to talk about cooking a dish. Adam, we brought it to a whole new level.
Yeah.
Dry-aged steaks used to be a steakhouse-only indulgence. An old-world charcuterie was pricey due to being imported or created at a small batch-specific scale. Thanks to UmiDry, their synthetic dry-aging bags and cases allow you to create these meat-crafting treats in your own kitchen. Working in tandem with your fridge, the UmiDry bag material allows moisture and air to pass through, making it possible to dry-age large cuts of steaks or roasts. Paired with their curing and seasoning kits, along with safe and easy-to-follow instructions, salamis and dry sausage are well within your grasp. Use the link in the show notes and sign up for the newsletter to receive 10% off your order. UmiDry, helping us elevate our wild game from the home kitchen.
As we've been talking about these dishes, and one that I want to work out with you too is I want to really get more use out of my wild pork. I know Harvesting Nature just got done with, I think this winter, you guys had a whole number of camps down in Texas. Were you a part of hosting some of that? Were you getting a chance to help help individuals break down pigs?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we throw in several now and are continuing to throw them for, you know, spring and fall seasons. And basically we bring people, we teach them how to hunt, how to break down a pig and process it and butcher it and clean it and store it and then cook it. So my role at all these camps is to instruct people how to cook the final product once my friend Adam Steele teaches them how to butcher it. So I get to help out with the butchering a little bit. He gets to help out in the kitchen a little bit, which is great, as well as Justin Townsend. He's there too, and he's an excellent cook and butcher. So it's great because we're just, you know, buddies hanging out, teaching people good skills. Yeah, and then I get to feed everyone too. So everyone arrives to I try to cook, you know, all sorts of, like the offal, the like parts of the pig that people probably haven't tried before. Mm-hmm. So they're welcomed to a feast basically of that. And then I teach people how to make a few dishes that they actually end up cooking for everyone else in the camp. So they get to cook it as well, which is nice. So they get hands-on experience. So yeah, I've gotten to cook a lot of different wild pig dishes, more so than I could have eaten myself, because I get to feed a ton of people. So that's kind of fun and nice. And we got basically endless access to wild pork while we're there. So yeah, that's really fun.
Excellent. Yeah, I got my chance. I took down a sizable boar this year. In fact, I've got him the skull mount. I'm just doing the Euro mount, but his tusks were big enough that I was like, oh man, like this needs to go on my desk. I need to make sure that I keep this one. It was super cool. Also, like really getting, I don't think it hit real hard. He still had, he was all intact. He still had all of his gear on him, which judging by the size of him, like there should have been more musk. There should have been more boar taint to him. Maybe I just caught him at a time where he was like, listen, I'm a bachelor. I'm just going to stay by myself. I'm not going to chase ladies. He was rooting around for grubs in a pasture. So I don't think he was really, he definitely wasn't rooting at that point, but there's a hint. There is that distinctive like touch of sour when I heat that meat up. Does not translate into the actual protein itself, but man, do you get a whiff of it while you're cooking. But then, yeah, it seems to dissipate, though, the closer and closer you get to actually serving it. So, no, boys have eaten it. My wife's eaten it. We've all enjoyed it. So it's like, hey, even the big males, even big boars can be consumed. I'm excited to do a wild boar sausage. Working on several different avenues as far as a recipe. I'm actually looking at one where I want to incorporate some blackberry, like it's a blackberry sausage. So I've gotten a few hints from a butcher who currently makes a domestic version of it. So I'm probing his brain. But let's take the idea of a wild boar sausage. I understand some fundamentals of sausage. Now, how do I want to make sure, how do I want to help myself continue to get a quality product at the end? My first time making wild boar sausage, but not my first time making sausage. Using kind of what we talked about with your dish, what are going to be some things that as I'm making sausage out of boar that I really want to make sure I note that I'm doing these per the science side?
Well, definitely wild boar, for the most part, is going to be a lot leaner than your domestic pig, which you might have been making sausage with. So you almost have to treat it more like a venison sausage than a traditional pork sausage. And you want to get those fat levels in the right place. I know I get a sense from a lot of hunters that they don't want to add fat to their grind or to their sausage because they want a pure flavor, or they don't like the idea of fat, extra fat in their diet. But to make a really good sausage, you need that high percentage of fat, which helps emulsify everything, which keeps it tender, which keeps it juicy. Without that, you're going to have an inferior product. So I'd recommend for people making wild boar sausage to, if you're not making it with a really fat sow, I would definitely add some outside, you know, pork back fat or something to it.
Yeah, I like how you said back fat. I've, in my experience making burger, I find that the back fat is actually really neutral tasting. My venison burgers taste like venison. They don't taste like pork. Versus if I were to incorporate a bacon, now you've got, you know, the nitrites, you got the smoke, you got all that that's going into there, and it really does, the bacon is so intense, it takes over what you're trying to do. But that back fat, you know, not going with belly, not going with shoulder, but really sticking to that back fat, you do avoid the, yeah, it doesn't, it plays in the background, I want to say. Like that domestic pork is mild enough that the wild, I think, will take over as far as flavor.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. It's a good way to add like a neutral fat to your dishes. And bacon can be good and stuff, but sometimes you want it to taste like what it tastes like, not like bacon every time. So, you know, I choose to grind up bacon sometimes into things, and most times I don't. But I would say the second step for making the sausage is to make a small batch of, even a small batch being like a little handful of plain sausage with, you know, the right amount of salt using ratios. And maybe black pepper, maybe a little sage, something very simple that you are used to and you can recognize the flavors. So you can then eat it and you don't have to like stuff it into sausages or anything. You can just like make a little patty, fry it up in the frying pan, eat it. And then you have a sense of what it tastes like on its own and any challenges you might face. So like you said, boar taint is sometimes an issue. If you're really picking up those flavors in your plain sausage, well, maybe you should consider making something like chorizo or you know, a very strongly flavored sausage that has enough spices in it that it kind of covers up that off flavor and allows you to enjoy the sausage on its own without getting any of that. If you taste it and you're like, oh, that just is really nice. You're like, you're not getting any of the taint. You're not getting any off flavors. You kind of get a sense of what the flavor profile is. From there, you can take, well, maybe I can do something more delicate like a blackberry sausage or a plain breakfast sausage or something. Maybe I can maybe I'm getting hints of something that I feel like juniper would go really good with, or garlic or something like that. So if you start out with a flavored sausage, you don't really know what kind of like palate you're working with to begin with. So I say that definitely that's a good way to approach it, and to then, have a base which you can experiment with, from it go in any direction with basically after that.
I am on board with what you just said. In fact, I made myself a note here next to my sausage page. Before I even bust out the casing, before I even, I get through the initial grind, make myself a patty of what I thought I was going to make. And from there, judge where that needs to go. If that, just like you mm-hmm. mentioned there, if that taint is just coming out super strong, hey, maybe my little delicate blackberry dish is not going to be the sausage that I want. And that's not even me mm-hmm. making the wrong avenue of, maybe I kept everything right. I kept it cold. I kept my ratios good, right amount of salt, but I didn't take in the fact of like what am I dealing with? What I'm not dealing with, again, a product that is going to match well with that light delicacy. It's going to have to go to a chorizo. But by making those observations first, using my nose, using my palate on something that's sacrificial, like a little, like you said, like a little patty, mm-hmm. quarter pound out of my full batch isn't going to hurt me, but it's going to give me a wealth of knowledge before I dive in and case that whole thing. And here I have now 20 pounds of, I have to like get myself geared up to eat this blueberry sausage, or excuse me, this blackberry sausage, because of how much taint is coming out of it.
It's like, how much mustard can I possibly put on this thing to make it edible?
Absolutely. You know what would have been really good? Chorizo. And then but I'm stuck. I'm already in. So observation first. Make yourself a sample patty before you apply it to the whole batch. I love that. I love that.
You know, that same can go for, if you're making meatballs, if you're making like a meatloaf or flavored burger grind, if you're adding different elements to it. I always will fry up a little piece. It takes a couple minutes, and then it gives me like, oh no, like what I thought was the right ratio is a little undersalted, or is a little, needs to be tamped down a little bit, or something. Or the flavors aren't necessarily as bright as I wanted them. But you find all that out by frying up a little piece and tasting it along the way. And that's a good way to, kind of like we were saying earlier, developing steps to the right flavor where you want and making observations. Just like in a recipe, you can do that, but in a all in one recipe, and just, tweak the flavors as you're making it by frying little bits up and tasting it, rather than, like you said, making a huge amount and then being like, oh, this isn't actually what I wanted.
I mean, it's a nice way to make dog food, but at the same time, I don't want to put all that investment into Fido right there. So making some observations, give yourself a sample of what that's going to be right before the full send. If you all of a sudden have, some things that are holding you back, then at that point, like, it's best to then, put it back in the chiller. Take the basic grind. Mm-hmm. You're not ready to incorporate that in. There's nothing to say that you can't put that in the fridge, put that in the freezer, play with something else, make another burger patty, or make another sausage patty with a different makeup, but just be ready to adapt, be ready to dodge. Don't be so gung-ho, tunnel visioned on that recipe mm-hmm. that you've already pre-decided that you can't steer out of the way of, an obvious roadblock, an obvious thing that's saying, hey, don't do this, but transition over to that. So be vigilant in not only your observations, but be ready to adapt. And I think that's
definitely
that, not only for a cook, but I would say, again, for a wild game cook, somebody trying to feed loved ones their hard earned harvest. That's got to be something in our toolbox that you know, if we're going to try something new, we see something trendy on Instagram or YouTube and we want to try that out, like be ready to do that for yourself before the the initial like offer it to others, because there's going to be some of those roadblocks that you're trying to get through. So beautiful. Absolutely.
And even when I'm butchering animals, I will fry up little pieces of it. You know, if I hunt a new animal, I bring it home and I'm butchering it, I'll take a little chunk, fry it up and be like, what does this animal taste like? What can I expect out of this animal? Is it an old deer? Is it from a cedar swamp? Is it an acorn fed wild pig? Is it a lean goose compared to a fatty goose? You know, I think these observational steps are even more important to the wild game cook, because our animals aren't just, you know, 8 weeks old, all the same, coming from the same place, like a lot of domestic food or domestic meats. These are, you know, creatures that are out and have different diets and different habitats and all these different things. And the flavor and the texture might be different. So using your observational skills and not just having a carte blanche approach to, you know, all deer should be cooked like this, all geese should be cooked like this. You get like, do some tasting and think about it and think of what, maybe this deer needs to be cooked longer. Maybe this deer has a different flavor than the last deer you brought home. Those observational skills are very important for the hunter, I would say.
Spot on, Adam. I couldn't have said it better myself. Just awesome wisdom from you, sir. Thank you so much. Hey, what are you currently working on right now? Like, what is in Adam's wheelhouse that you're working on in your own test kitchen?
I think it's just it's a constant kind of thing. One thing I do have right now is a bunch of old roosters from a friend of mine who was getting sick of their roosters. So I helped them out by bringing them home, putting them in my freezer. So I have, you know, a few of them. So, and I know there's some traditional dishes like coq au vin, which is like a French wine braised rooster dish. You're dealing with, like I said, like an older animal that's a lot tougher than your, you know, fryer chicken you bring home from the grocery store. But there's flavor to be had there, big time flavor. You just have to find ways to extract it and make the meat palatable because it's so much tougher than a normal chicken. So that's something that I've been, you know, using these observational skills like we've been talking about, doing them one at a time, and getting a sense of the meat itself and what I can do with it. I think from there, I might try out a traditional recipe like coq au vin and do it from start to finish. And then from there, I might start, you know, experimenting with where I can bring it, which will give me some good insight into, you know, tougher, older birds that I hunt as well. So maybe geese. I just did a podcast about snow geese, and I read the oldest one was like that they found is like 27 years old or something crazy like that.
Jeez, old beats.
Which was shot by hunter, and yeah, so you know that's going to be a tough old bird. But some of the insight I gained from cooking up these roosters will definitely lend itself to cooking or running into those issues with wild game if you get a really tough old animal. I think I'll be learning a lot from it, and so I've been kind of working with those, which has been pretty neat.
Are you finding, is it more the texture as opposed to the flavor, or is it got its own intensity when it comes to the meat itself? What seems to be your biggest hurdle with those older birds?
Well, I think it's definitely the texture. They're so much tougher, darker, kind of scrawnier than like a, you know, fat chicken that doesn't move ever like that we often get from the grocery store. So you're trying to get the meat to the point where it's tender, but not like over dried out. You know, when you braise something for too long and it's kind of like has this dry texture.
Yes.
And I don't always want to pull it and shred it. I want to find some ways to potentially cook it and keep it a little more whole. But the flavor itself is not a hurdle. The flavor has been exceptional. If you can picture like a really like a, high quality chicken bouillon cube. It's like it was taken from a rooster. Like, that's the flavor I'm getting.
Gotcha.
I don't have to add as much flavor as I would the domestic chicken. It's a really cool ingredient. It's something that a lot of cultures still use, but the European, North American culture doesn't use them anymore. And they're probably all going to the dog food factories or whatever, but I think you're missing out on some potential big, awesome flavors. It's just a matter of learning how to cook it properly, because they are challenging.
Yeah. Maybe this is just a side thing too. Maybe it's just my conspiracy theorist going on, but if inflation keeps going up, I think the hits on rooster recipes, people have a ton of backyard chickens. Like, I think it's, there's going to be less and less roosters going to the pile, and people are going to figure out, you know what? I put money into this thing. It eats my grain. You know, it's going to have to do the payback someday. I think the American palate, with as inflation going up, with food prices going up, and even food safety seeming to be a little iffy at points, we might start to see people jumping over to your podcast, my podcast. How do we cook these critters that are something that we can acquire ourselves?
I agree with that totally. I think that offal is going to come back in. Just like in the financial crisis in the 30s and whatever, like, I think, like, gardening your own vegetables, getting cheaper cuts like offal and shanks and all these things that are generally ignored, head cheese, like all the fun stuff that I love and I think you love and a lot of the guys like us love, I think are going to come back into vogue, because food is just too damn expensive now. And finding those ways of stretching meals and adding cheaper, often overlooked products like offal and like roosters and like these things, I think it's definitely going to come back in. And we'll be waiting there with our recipes for you to join.
Absolutely, absolutely. Adam, this has just been a fun hour. Thank you so much for your time. Where can my listeners continue to dive into your content? Where can we find more about Adam? Where can we find you online?
Well, you can follow me on social media as The Intrepid Eater. And I also have a website called theintrepideater.com. I have over 500 recipes, lots of wild stuff, foraged, fish, game, all sorts of stuff. I have video techniques. I can also be found on harvestinnature.com. I work with those guys as well. So yeah. And then I have my podcast, Antler and Fin, which is on the Wild Fish and Game podcast or Harvesting Nature. And, feel free to DM me with any, you know, questions about what you're doing or what you're cooking, or if you need to know anything. I'm always happy to help and to chat with people.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Adam, hold on for just a second. I'm going to let our listeners on out. Folks, I hope you enjoyed this past hour. This is really where rubber is meeting the road, that you have things that you want to make. You have favorites, and you may have those on a recipe card. You may even pull that out of a book. But if you've gotten to the point now where you want to start making it your own, that's where that recipe can really come alive. That's where that dish can go from on paper to becoming something that's out of your heart, out of your soul, that you get to make those additions, you get to make those subtractions and changes, and that dish then takes on a new ownership, that takes on your embodiment. And so as you look at that, make sure you're using your observation skills. What is it that I want to add into it? What is happening with this meat, or what is happening with this dish when I do this? Be ready to adapt. Sometimes those flavors don't meld well, or in the case of being in our wild proteins, you might get a one that lives outside of the paradigm where it's going to need a stronger flavor from you, or it could probably need a milder flavor that you're going to be wanting to add. But whatever you're going to be doing, whether it's going to be cutting up an old rooster or whether it's going to be gutting that real young doe that's got a big fat layer on it, make sure the knife that you are using is very sharp.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.